Hello, this is Dr. Rajneesh Mago. I'm here at the American Psychiatric Association annual meeting in Atlanta, Georgia in May 2016. And I'm here with Dr. Vimal Aga, who is assistant professor at Oregon Health and Sciences University in Portland, Oregon. He's a geriatric psychiatrist with extensive clinical experience. And he has been doing a workshop at the American Psychiatric Association meeting about the role of neuroimaging in the diagnosis of dementia. Thank you, Dr. Aga, for agreeing to speak to us and share with us some clinical tips about the use of neuroimaging in the diagnosis of dementia. So let me start by first asking you, as a general psychiatrist, why do I need to learn about neuroimaging? Why can I not just refer the patient to a specialist for evaluation?
Thank you for having me, Dr. Mago. So the answer to your question is that under ideal circumstances, it would be best to refer if you're not familiar with diagnosing and treating cognitive disorders in patients. But the reality is that there are not enough cognitivists out there in the country to see your patients. These include people with neurological training who have additional interest in diagnosing cognitive disorders. And keep in mind that all neurologists don't have the same interest or the same experience in diagnosing these disorders. And the same goes for geriatric medicine folks and geriatric psychiatrists. So there's really a shortage of people at the top, at the specialist level, who can diagnose and treat such patients. So the first level work really has to be done at your level, at the level of the primary care physician or the adult psychiatrist.
Thank you. So if I see when I'm seeing patients with cognitive impairment, let's say a middle-aged person or an older person, which patients do I need to order neuroimaging for? I mean, we can't order neuroimaging for all patients, can we?
So things changed drastically around 2000 because a study came out that found that the prediction rules that were being used at that time to figure out which patients needed to go for neuroimaging, those prediction rules were really faulty. Their positive prediction value was less than 15%, and therefore a lot of patients with potentially reversible dementias got missed. And as you can understand, especially in this country, that has huge liability implications for physicians. So in 2001, the American Academy of Neurology was the first one to come out with recommendations that all patients in whom dementia is suspected for the first time need at least one brain scan. This has now been the recommendation of other societies since then. Most recently, the European Federation of Neurological Societies, their recommendations came out in 2012, and again they say all patients with new onset dementia or in whom dementia is suspected need at least one brain scan. The EFNS actually went one step further than the AAN recommendations and said ideally this should be an MRI scan of the brain.
So you're saying that, you know, even if I see a patient who clinically seems to have typical onset of, age-related Alzheimer's disease, I'm making a clinical diagnosis of Alzheimer's disease, yet I might be missing cases of reversible dementia. So really, even if I think it is a typical case, I should still order neuroimaging in all cases of new onset of cognitive impairment, especially in an older patient.
So patients who have the typical late-onset amnestic Alzheimer's disease are the patients who are most suited to be diagnosed and treated at the level of the primary care physician or the adult psychiatrist. But yes, even these patients need at least that one brain scan to make sure you're not missing a reversible cause of dementia such as NPH or a brain tumor or a subdural, which can be pretty common in older folks. So you still need that one brain scan, but in the patients with the amnestic late-onset Alzheimer's disease, which is interestingly and fortunately the most common kind of dementia out there, I think these patients can, in the vast majority of cases, be diagnosed and treated at the level of the adult psychiatrist or the primary care physician.
Now, what about other kinds of symptoms? If we see an older patient and who presents not with cognitive impairment but with other new onset symptoms like depression or psychosis and so on, is it possible that could be the initial manifestation of a dementia?
So there are other kinds of dementias, most notably frontotemporal dementia, and there's a lot of research coming out in this area now that suggests that frontotemporal dementia does not present with the typical cognitive symptoms the way we think about them. So you will not see problems with memory or visuospatial deficits or even problems with language in some kinds of frontotemporal dementias. There are other frontotemporal dementias which are language-based, but in behavior variant frontotemporal dementia, which accounts for about 50% of the FTD spectrum, you expect changes to be in the area of what DSM-5 calls social cognition. So it's in the area of social behaviors and executive function. But remember, executive function is not the hallmark of behavior variant frontotemporal dementia. It's social behaviors. And so when people present with new onset problems with social behaviors after age 40, one of the recommendations from a big study, not from any association or society, is that patients with new onset behavioral change after age 40, not 50 or 60, are also patients where frontotemporal dementia behavior variant type should be suspected, and you should think about getting a brain scan for these patients or think about referring them to a specialist for a brain scan and a complete workup.
So it seems like you're saying that we might be missing cases of frontotemporal dementia, and in order to not miss cases, we need to be more alert and to be thinking about FTD more often in patients who present with behavioral changes in order to diagnose these patients early on.
Exactly, and there are studies that show this, that about 50% of patients with behavior variant frontotemporal dementia are diagnosed with a primary psychiatric disorder an average of 2.7 years before they are diagnosed with or re-diagnosed with behavior variant frontotemporal dementia. And these patients commonly present with very common symptoms such as depression, bipolar disorder, could be mania, or compulsive symptoms, or even eating problems. So they might be diagnosed with a major depression or a bipolar disorder way before they're actually re-diagnosed with the correct diagnosis, that's frontotemporal dementia. So we have to be very careful in such patients.
Would they always have like cognitive symptoms at the same time, or if we do a clinical cognitive function testing, will that not be sufficient?
So the clinical cognitive screens, the most common of which is the MoCA, which is in practice now, you'll be very unlikely to pick up behavior variant frontotemporal dementia on the MoCA. You can easily score, especially in the very early stages, you can easily score 30 out of 30 on the MoCA and yet have florid behavior variant frontotemporal dementia. So that's not an adequate screen for this very complicated and very complex condition.
So, Dr. Agar, so if we do order the neuroimaging, what would be some examples of reversible causes of dementia that we are looking for? What kind of things are we looking for in the neuroimaging?
So the commonest reasons to have reversible cognitive impairment is NPH, normal pressure hydrocephalus. In older folks, you can have strokes. At any age, you can have brain tumors. And in older people, again, you can have subdural hemorrhages. So those are the commonest reasons for people to have a reversible dementia. But the number of people or the proportion of people who have a reversible dementia actually ends up being quite low. And recent studies indicate it's way less than 5%, and some studies even indicate as low as about 2.2%. So the proportion is low, but at the individual patient level, it's very hard to know when the symptoms are from a primary dementia versus a reversible cause, and that's why you must do a brain scan. Also, adding to something I said in response to the earlier question about frontotemporal dementia, the problem at the individual patient level is that when somebody presents with a depression due to FTD or a depression due to major depression, the symptomatology is exactly alike. So at the individual patient level, there is no clinical phenotype so far that can help you distinguish between FTD and depression due to a major depressive disorder.
So even though the percentage of patients in whom you'll have a finding in the neuroimaging that might be a reversible cause might be only 2 to 5%, but still it is worth it to do scans in every person in order to identify these 2 to 5% people, because for some people that could be very significant, and some of these causes can be treated very nicely, like normal pressure hydrocephalus or if there is an intracranial space occupying lesion.
Absolutely, that's correct.
So, Dr. Aga, we decided that, you know, we are going to be much more vigilant, and thank you for alerting us to the issue of having a low threshold for thinking about frontotemporal dementia. So when we decide to order the imaging, should the psychiatrist be the one to order imaging, or should it be the primary care doctor? And which imaging should we order?
So the decision needs to be made about whether you are comfortable ordering a brain scan and then treating the patient if there is a positive diagnosis. And that's why people at the primary care level, whether it's adult psychiatrist or other primary care physicians like internal medicine and family practice, why they need to know at least the basics of diagnosing dementia on a brain scan. So again, there are not enough people at the top at the specialist level to diagnose these conditions, and that's why I strongly encourage people at the primary care level to become cognizant of what is in the brain scan, how you order a brain scan, and how you diagnose dementia on the brain scan. The larger problem also is that if you are expecting your friendly neighborhood radiologist to diagnose these dementias on the brain scan for you, I have news for you, that's not going to happen. There are, again, studies to back it up that most radiologists will not diagnose dementia on a brain scan because either they have not been trained to do that, which unfortunately is the case in some cases, or they just have no interest in doing that because they feel, like most other people do, that dementia is an untreatable condition. So they might even go as far as to say that there is regional atrophy in a certain part of the brain, which for you might mean that somebody has dementia, but then that's all they will say, which is somewhat like saying if you send somebody for a tibial fracture, you will never find a radiologist that says the tibial shaft is in two pieces, one inch apart, but that not go on to say that they have a tibial shaft fracture. But that's what they often do in patients with dementia. They might say that there is extensive regional atrophy in the temporal lobes bilaterally, and then not further qualify that by saying which is consistent with the diagnosis of Alzheimer's disease.
So as psychiatrists, we need to understand that they will give us the finding on the brain scan, but we need to have a basic understanding of what does that finding mean in correlating it with our clinical findings, so that we are the ones who have to diagnose whether this person looks like they have Alzheimer's disease or they have frontotemporal dementia.
It's extremely variable as to whether you will even get the finding. It depends on the level of interest that the radiologist has, the level of training, and whether you're sending them to a special center that specializes in diagnosing dementia. In most cases, you will actually not even get the finding. And in many cases that I have seen in my practice, there's extensive atrophy. When I bring it up in my workshop and show it to people, people sort of gasp when I tell them that this scan was read as normal by the radiologist. Because again, it doesn't have the same implications for the radiologist as it might have for us.
So Dr. Aga, you're a specialist, but for us as general adult psychiatrists, this is very worrisome. So what do you think we should do as general adult psychiatrists? What kind of scan should we order? And then what should we do with the report that we get?
So we need to become familiar with, one, how to order a brain scan in dementia patients, and two, how to read the brain scan in dementia patients. The scan of choice in almost every case is an MRI scan of the brain without contrast. There are certain conditions where you need contrast, which I will not go into here, but suffice to say, for example, rapidly progressive dementia, or if you're considering vasculitis, those are all conditions where you should not really be treating the patient. They are outside the scope of a psychiatric practice. So whenever you think I need to order contrast in a patient, you should also think, should I refer this patient to a neurologist, because this is outside the scope of my practice. But anything that you feel comfortable treating should be a patient who needs a brain scan, an MRI scan of the brain without contrast. Now, there are some situations where you need a CT scan of the brain and not an MRI. And those are patients who are sensitive to noise because, as you know, the MRI machines can be extremely noisy. These are patients who are claustrophobic, and for some reason you don't want to pre-medicate them with Ativan. These are patients who have medical devices, and that's fairly common in the older population, especially a pacemaker, which is not MRI compatible. And then patients where either they are self-pay and they can't afford an MRI, or the insurance company refuses to cover an MRI, those are the situations where you want to order a CT scan of the brain instead of an MRI. But even then, if you order a CT scan of the brain, try to order a helical or a spiral CT of the brain, so at least you have images in all three planes, and you can look at the hippocampi bilaterally in the coronal plane, which is the best way to look at it, because in an axial plane, it's much harder to diagnose hippocampal atrophy unless it's extremely severe.
Okay, so you're saying for the majority of the cases that an adult psychiatrist will see in outpatient practice are probably going to be Alzheimer's disease. And so for the routine, for most of the patients, what we need to order is an MRI without contrast. MRI without contrast. In some situations, we may think of MRI with contrast, but those might be the cases where we might want to refer the patient. And then if we want to order a CT, you said order a helical or spiral CT. So how do we write that on the order? Do we just call it helical order for helical CT of brain? Is that how we write the prescription?
So helical and spiral CT are one and the same thing. And the way you would write the order would be a helical CT of the brain with images in all three planes. And the indication would be late onset Alzheimer's disease. So that's how you would order it. And again, it would be without contrast, just like the MRI would be without contrast.
Is there any problem in getting the insurance to approve or pay for these two tests, MRI without contrast or a helical CT scan? Does insurance usually pay for these?
It's becoming much easier over the years to get insurance companies to pay. They will almost always pay for a CT scan because it's much cheaper than an MRI. But in my practice, I've seldom had problems with insurance companies even paying, or Medicare even paying for an MRI. It's when you get to a PET scan, which is a functional scan, that you run into problems. But most insurance companies and Medicare are okay with getting an MRI scan of the brain. The one thing to keep in mind, though, is if it's an older patient, he or she might already have had a CT scan of the brain, because they often go to the ER with falls, for example, and that's typically what they do, is a CT scan just in the axial plane, not a helical CT. So those patients might already have a CT scan of the brain, and then you might first want to look at the scan and see if you still want to order further imaging after you've looked at the scan, because in some cases there's just incredible amount of hippocampal atrophy that's even visible in the axial plane in the CT scan, and then no further imaging is indicated in those cases.
Okay, so we order most of our patients are going to be Alzheimer's disease. We order an MRI without contrast. In the typical Alzheimer's disease patient, what are we expecting to see on the MRI? What kind of findings would we consider are just to be expected in Alzheimer's disease?
So the age at onset really modulates the changes that you might see on a brain MRI in Alzheimer's disease. So with early onset patients, these are patients who have onset of Alzheimer's disease before age 65, there's more parietal atrophy. And then the older you get, there is more medial temporal atrophy. So in your typical late onset amnestic Alzheimer's disease patient, you will see bitemporal atrophy. There are actually rating scales that are available and have been available for many years to rate all kinds of atrophy in the brain in dementia patients. So there's a rating scale for parietal atrophy, there's a rating scale for medial temporal atrophy, and I would strongly encourage you to, if you're interested in this area, to read up about the scales and become familiar with just a few, not many, but just a few, because that's a much more standardized way to read the brain scans. So you would be looking for fairly symmetrical bitemporal temporal atrophy with or without parietal atrophy in your typical amnestic late-onset Alzheimer's disease patient. And this is best seen in the coronal plane, either in a T1-weighted MRI image or in the T2-weighted flare sequence. So those are the two sequences where you look for medial temporal atrophy. Never look for medial temporal or any other kind of atrophy in heavily T2-weighted sequences, because you can overestimate atrophy in T2-weighted sequences.
Okay, so if in the MRI, we order the MRI and it comes back with bitemporal symmetrical atrophy and or parietal atrophy, that means that this is consistent with Alzheimer's disease. In general, in most cases, there is no need to do any further scanning. And we proceed to treat the patient as Alzheimer's disease. Am I understanding this correctly?
As long as the clinical presentation and cognitive screening in the clinic is consistent with that diagnosis, so it's gradually progressive cognitive impairment, mostly involving episodic memory, and then you find problems with delayed recall in your cognitive screening and functional impairment in clinical screening in your office. The delayed recall deficit in Alzheimer's disease is typically of the amnestic type, or it's amnestic disorder of the hippocampal type, which is really a fancy way of saying that when you cue the patient, it does not normalize the cognitive or the amnestic deficit.
So what you're saying is, so you ask the patient to remember the three words, patient says, I cannot remember, and then you tell them the words and they still cannot remember. Is that what you mean by cueing them?
Right, so I always prefer to use the MoCA instead of the mini mental state exam. So if there's one take-home message from this, it's stop using the mini mental state exam because it's highly insensitive. But with the MoCA, it's actually five words, not three. And then cueing means that there are two sets of cues in the MoCA. You give them category cues. So for example, if one of the word was dog, you might say it was an animal. And then the second set of cues are multiple choice options. So you say, was it a dog? Was it a cat? Was it a monkey? And then if the patient still doesn't recognize the word correctly, then that's an amnestic disorder of the hippocampal type.
And that is what we will expect in Alzheimer's disease patients, that even giving them this kind of hint about the category or multiple choice, they still cannot answer. That's what we would expect in Alzheimer's disease patients.
That is correct.
Thank you so much, Dr. Aga, for taking the time to speak to us. This has been very helpful. These are clinical tips that adult psychiatrists can put into practice right away. And certainly I'm also going to be more aware of the need to order neuroimaging in patients that I see, both with cognitive impairment and in those who present with new onset of behavioral changes after the age of 40. Thank you, Dr. Aga.